Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
So did you guys hear about this whole thing of, like, House Republicans trying to rename the airport, like Dulles Airport, after Trump?
You know, on the list of things that I would want to be named after me, I think Dulles Airport would probably be towards the bottom.
Really?
There's, like, a waste facility that could be named after you that might be a little bit better.
Hot take. I really like Dulles Airport.
Oh, my gosh.
It's an architectural marvel.
I agree with this. Dulles is a beautiful airport.
I'm questioning how much you guys fly out of that airport because I totally disagree.
Yeah, I say that now and then I go into kayak and I'm like, nope, not flying out of Dulles. Welcome to The Campaign Moment on this Friday, April 5th. I'm Martine Powers, co-host of Post Reports.
And I'm Aaron Blake, senior political reporter at The Post. I also write the Campaign Moment newsletter. And rounding out the group this week is national political reporter Isaac Arnsdorf. Thanks for being here, Isaac.
Thanks for having me.
Aaron, you're forgetting Isaac's most important title, which is former co-editor of mine from our college newspaper.
I did not know that.
Way back.
Which newspaper? What's the name of it?
We don't have to.
It's not the Crimson, is it?
Definitely not.
Okay.
The Yale Daily News.
Oh, okay, good.
Gilmore Girls fame.
Much better.
I thought you were going to say, though, Martine, author of the new book that comes out on Tuesday.
Well, I was going to get there.
Okay.
That is one of the reasons why we're talking to Isaac today, in addition to the fact that he is closely covering this election, breaking all kinds of news. He also has this book that is coming out this coming week, and it's called Finish What We Started, The MAGA Movement's Ground War to End Democracy, which I love, bright, optimistic title about the future. So we're going to talk about that book later in the conversation today. But Isaac, I was just curious to get a sense from you, because I feel like I talk to a lot of real people out in the world. I think listeners in many ways feel this way, who feel already very burnt out by this election, or like the Trump-Biden rematch, depressing, boring. But I feel like I talk to you and you're enthusiastic and excited and like raring to go. So tell me, what have you found so far that's been like new and interesting about this election that has made you excited to cover it?
Well, I mean, a surprising finding in some polls this week were actually how many voters are undecided. And so we kind of think about this being a rematch and both candidates having basically universal name ID and like having already run for president not that long ago. And like, what else is there to think? But actually, there's a huge piece of the electorate that is still deciding and hasn't figured out how they're going to vote.
So we will talk about some of the where the undecided vote fits in. We're going to talk about big news from Florida in terms of this abortion ban and a ballot question that could affect November. But I also want to start the conversation today by talking about big news from the Trump trials. There's two pieces of news. First, I think we're going to talk about my favorite of the four cases, as we know, because I'm a Florida girl, the classified documents trial. And there was this kind of tension that has bubbled up between special counsel Jack Smith and the judge in this case. Honestly, I tried to like read and unpack what was happening here, and I really don't understand it. It's something about like directions to a jury. But Aaron and Isaac, I know that you both are better read in on this stuff. Can you explain a little bit like what is going on in the Florida case that was so notable?
Yeah, it is super dense, and I'll warn people up front, but I think it's also super important. One, because this is probably Trump's most legally problematic prosecution, and also because this is really, as you mentioned, the situation involving the judge and the decisions that she's making coming to a head. There's been a lot of concern. You know, she was appointed by Trump to the bench. She's been overturned on some things. So this is kind of the moment.
She's very young.
Yes, she's very young. This is a moment that has been coming for a very long time in some ways. So the Trump legal team initially filed a motion to dismiss that cited this argument that these were actually personal records. They cite something called the Presidential Records Act. And so basically they're saying these are not classified documents. These are actually personal records that he designated. And the idea is that he can't be held legally accountable for that. The judge has actually now rejected that argument and not dismissed the case. But before she did so, she actually asked the two sides to submit proposed jury instructions to take into account this argument that these were personal documents under the Presidential Records Act.
But this was the first part that was confusing to me. It's like, why is this case doesn't have a trial date yet?
Right.
There's no jury. Like, why at this point is she asking them to submit instructions to a jury or like potential instructions?
Well, I think you're right to be confused about that. I think the special counsel's office was confused about that also. I mean, their response, I mean, in legal language was kind of like, that's not a thing.
Yeah. So explain more, like, what is she trying to achieve here, or what was raising such a red flag about this request?
Well, it accepts the premise of the argument that the Trump lawyers are trying to make, that these were his records under the Presidential Records Act, and he had some authority to decide what was going to be returned to the National Archives or not. And the special counsel Jack Smith's argument is like, no, this isn't about the Presidential Records Act. That's completely irrelevant. This is about the Espionage Act. This is about classified materials. It doesn't matter whether he thinks they're personal or not. They're supposed to be in a secure facility. They're not supposed to be in a box next to the toilet.
And this is something I think it's worth pointing out, that experts are like pretty much unanimous that the Presidential Records Act has really no bearing on this case. And we had a big story about that a couple weeks ago. So the fact that, you know, she didn't say that this is relevant, but she put it out there in a way that suggests it might be. And so what we had from Special Counsel Jack Smith was a pretty biting filing in which he said on six occasions that this legal premise was wrong. He basically complied with her request for jury instructions, but also did so in a way that made clear that the Presidential Records Act had no bearing. So, like, it's a very kind of interestingly worded proposal from them that kind of gets at the red herring that they think that this is.
Basically, like, sure, we'll give you this information, but, like, to be clear, we think you're completely wrong and this is out of line that you're asking.
That's basically the entire thrust of the filing.
And if you do this, we're going to appeal.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the other important thing here, is that they threaten to appeal and they want the judge to rule on this quickly so that they can appeal before it ever gets to trial, because once the trial starts, you can't appeal. And if he's acquitted, you can't appeal that. So in one way, this is all very, you know, remarkable that she would ask this and that they would respond in this way. But the fact that we're also having this discussion before the trial begins is actually probably a good thing legally, because once the trial begins, it's kind of the point of no return on issues like this.
And just to be clear, has Judge Cannon responded at all to the kind of criticism put out there by Jack Smith, or almost the threat that he was thinking of appealing this?
Yeah, she has. As part of her rejecting the motion, the Trump team's motion to dismiss on Thursday, Judge Cannon basically said, don't read too much into what I've done here. She said that her proposed jury instructions, quote, should not be misconstrued as declaring a final definition of any essential element or asserted defense in this case. Basically, sounds like she's saying, I did not just accept this premise. I was just asking for ideas from you guys. I also think it's important to note that Cannon dismissing the motion to dismiss does not take this issue off the table. This is a very live issue, because she hasn't said that it's not a part of this case. And so we still could see appeals that come out of this. We still could see clashes that come out of this. And so we haven't heard the end of this. And the fact that Jack Smith's team decided to speak in these terms and it's filing this week really reflects how significant they think this is and how likely they are to continue pressing this issue.
Hmm. And we should contextualize, part of what's so striking about this is you don't usually see the parties taking that kind of tone with the judge in the trial. Like, that's generally considered a risky thing to do, unless you're Trump's lawyers, in which case all you do is antagonize the judge.
Well, on that subject, why don't we turn now to talk to the New York trial, which is supposed to be officially starting in a couple of weeks. And yet we already have, to Isaac's point, some increasing tension over what Trump is saying publicly about the trial. There has been a gag order in which he's been told not to talk about individuals involved in the trial. And yet it seems like adhering to the spirit of that gag order has been difficult for the former president. Can you guys unpack a little bit what has happened there?
Well, I think we should say a gag order sounds scary, but it's actually very routine in a criminal trial. It's very standard to restrict what the parties are saying publicly so that they're not litigating it publicly outside the courtroom. What's unusual is having a major party presidential presumptive nominee as the defendant. And so that's the clash we're getting here.
Yeah, and basically, Trump has already violated gag orders in a separate case twice. Arguably three times, though the third time he wasn't sanctioned. And so this order came in late on Monday night. And by Tuesday morning, Trump was on Truth Social. And he, you know, basically the gag order deals with the idea that he can't be attacking the family of the judge or the district attorney. And Trump had been pointing to the fact that the judge's daughter works for a Democratic-aligned digital media company. And So Trump, you know, has been saying that, and then he gets gagged. And then on Tuesday morning, shortly after the gag order is put in place, he again refers to, quote, conflicts taking place in the courtroom while deriding the gag order. And then the next hour, he posts a Fox News video in which Brian Kilmeade, the Fox and Friends morning host, basically recites the claims that Trump had been gagged for making.
Just on the massive gag order put on the former president of the United States in the Alvin Bragg case, because they don't want him talking about prosecutor Matthew Colangelo, and they don't want him talking about the judge's daughter. But Matthew Colangelo was in the Justice Department with Joe Biden. That is outrageous to President Trump. Also, the fact is, the judge's daughter is a activist who works for Kamala Harris. And there was some dispute on...
Wait, so the idea of posting this video is like, sure, I'm not allowed to say this thing about how this whole thing is, you know, stacked against me. But like, here's a video of someone else saying the thing that I'm not now allowed to say. Is that the vibe there?
Well, he can criticize the gag order, generally speaking, and he can, mm-hmm. you know, point to conflicts taking place in the courtroom. That's probably not a violation. I think this was intentional from Trump because this is how he operates. And he didn't highlight that portion of what the video was saying, but that was a part of the video that he posted that was basically saying the exact things that he had been gagged for. And so this is another example of Trump just pushing the envelope on these gag orders and basically daring the judicial system to sanction him and do something about it, at which point he can again claim that he is being persecuted.
Or he gets away with it.
Or he gets away with it, yes.
And, well, that's my question, right? Like, what are the tools available to the judge to actually prevent him from doing this if it continues? I mean, are there, like, what are the potential penalties or punishments?
So the most obvious ones are fines, which Trump has been fined for violating gag orders, $15,000 so far. Of course, the most drastic one is you can actually be thrown in jail if you do this. That is obviously a drastic step for a case involving a former president and presidential candidate. I doubt a judge would ever go that far. But, you know, I think Ty Cobb, the former White House lawyer in Trump's administration, has gone so far as to predict that will happen at some point because Trump just won't stop. What's interesting here is that the judge took a little bit of a different tack. He mentioned those possibilities if Trump violates the gag orders, but he also threw out the possibility that if Trump does this, he could withhold the names and identities of jurors from Trump's legal team. And that would be significant because every legal team wants to scrutinize these people before jury selection and make sure that they get a panel of people that are, you know, not as bad for them as they could otherwise be.
The reason for doing that on its face would be that because Trump has this track record of threatening people involved in the case, that would be the reason for not letting him and his team see who they are. But it would have the effect of limiting their ability to scrub the jury.
Interesting. So I guess we will see if that happens in the next couple of weeks. Now I want to turn to what seemed to me like the other big political news of this week, and that is what has been happening in Florida. Because of a court decision, the 6-week abortion ban in Florida is now about to go into place. And at the same time, we now know that there's going to be a ballot question on the ballot in November, where Floridians can decide whether they want to protect abortion rights in their state constitution. We talked about this a little bit, or a lot of it, on Tuesday's episode of Post Reports. So I think people who listen to that might know the broad strokes of this. And obviously, it has huge implications for people who might need an abortion between now and the end of the year. But I also want to talk about politically how this is playing out. And this question of like whether this is going to put Florida back in play in terms of being an important swing state on the political map.
Yeah, well, there's no question that that is the idea for Democrats in putting these measures on the ballot. They're trying to get them on the ballot in a lot of states ahead of this election. The idea is that it either juices turnout or it frames the election in a way that is more favorable to them. We've seen these abortion ballot measures pass without fail since Roe v. Wade was overturned. They've always been a favorable outcome for Democrats and for abortion rights supporters, even in red states. So getting this on the ballot is a win for Democrats. As for whether it's going to flip a state like Florida, I think it's difficult. It was a former swing state, but it's been trending red. Trump won it by 3 points in 2020. Governor DeSantis won it by 19 in 2022. Mm-hmm. But this is also something that there are other races on the ballot. There's a very key Senate race there. If you look at the other states that could have these on the ballot, Arizona should be very close to the presidential and Senate level. Montana is a key Senate race. Maryland's a key Senate race. New York will have an abortion rights ballot measure. It has lots of key House races. And so I think that the idea is that in the past, this hasn't necessarily juiced turnout. There was a 2004 push that was similar from Republicans to get same-sex marriage on the ballot, and some wagered that that helped George W. Bush get reelected by winning Ohio. Hmm. There's some kind of mixed evidence on that. But I think most of all, this is just a way for Democrats to keep the abortion issue present, not just in these states, but in the country more broadly, by having this be a relevant issue that voters are actually voting on.
And it also seems to be a way to specifically juice turnout among young people, right? That you hear so many young voters who are like, why would I bother to vote, you know, to go to the polls to vote for these two old guys? But that when you put this question on the ballot, that feels so explicit, and that, you know, if young people are showing up to the polls to like make their voices heard on abortion, that it feels like the back door to get them to say, well, maybe I'll end up voting for Biden.
Nevada is another one that is a presidential battleground and is a key Senate race, and it's going to have abortion on the ballot. That could make a difference. The thing about Florida is if Florida is competitive, right, then the Democrats have probably already won Georgia and North Carolina, in which case you don't need Florida. Hmm. So I'm pretty skeptical that they can really make a play for Florida. But what they can do is do a head fake in Florida, force the Republicans to spend money there. And it's an expensive state because it has so many media markets. And so even just in the game theory of the overall electoral map, even just putting the Republicans on defense a little bit in Florida, when the Democrats have a huge money advantage, that could end up mattering in other places.
Oh, interesting. Because I think there was a thought of like, well, maybe Democrats shouldn't be distracted by this, by spending money in Florida when they need to be focusing on other places that they're more likely to win. But what you're saying is essentially like, no, if they can make some kind of conceivable fight in Florida, that it's worse for Republicans to spend money there than it is for Democrats to spend money there, because Joe Biden has more money than Trump at this point.
Exactly.
Yeah. And to your point, Martine, about turnout, like I mentioned the 2004 same-sex marriage example where Republicans pushed the ballot measures, didn't seem to have much increase in turnout. A lot of that is because a lot of casual people already vote in presidential elections. These are the highest turnout elections that we have. But in this case, it's a very good point because President Biden has an enthusiasm problem in his base. There's a lot of people who will turn out to vote against Donald Trump, but not necessarily because they feel strongly about President Biden. So if young people feel strongly about this, if this helps certain people, you know, get over their concerns about Biden's handling of the war in Gaza, I think that Democrats could use every kind of voting motivator that they can get because their candidate isn't that compelling to people right now.
I also think that the ballot question in Florida is kind of throwing into relief how these two candidates are talking about abortion. And Aaron, we've had conversations in the past about Biden where he understands that abortion is like a really good issue for Democrats and yet is like a little comfortable talking in explicit terms about abortion. But it does seem like he's kind of figuring that out, right? Like we have this new ad that came out in Florida this week with Biden talking about here's where I stand on abortion versus Donald Trump. And we're going to take a listen to that ad.
Because for 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it.
In 2016, Donald Trump ran to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, in 2024, he's running to pass a national ban on a woman's right to choose. I'm running to make Roe v. Wade the law of the land again, so women have a federal guarantee to the right to choose. Donald Trump doesn't trust women. I do. I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
So that's what you're hearing from Biden this week. And then you have Trump, who I think has not really been able to figure out how to talk about abortion. Like in the past, as this ad has suggested, has taken pride in the fact that the Supreme Court, with justices who were nominated by him, that they overturned Roe v. Wade. And then more recently, you have him saying, actually, I think a 6-week ban is terrible. What is going on here for Trump, and how is he trying to navigate this moment on abortion?
It's pretty abundantly clear that Trump does not know what to do with this issue now. Banning abortion and overturning Roe v. Wade were always much better in theory than in practice, at least politically, for Republicans. And ever since it was overturned, you've seen them struggle with what to do now that they actually have the ability to restrict abortion. And so we saw a lot of candidates in 2022 who had come out for, you know, no exceptions abortion bans, who really suffered because of that. And what we've seen since Trump launched his campaign is he hasn't been able to take a position on this. He oscillates on what kind of time frame might be good. He oscillates on what, you know, whether this should be strictly a state issue or whether he might support a federal ban. It's basically been a year of him not really having a hard position on this issue. And then we came to this week and the Florida ballot measure going on the ballot, you know, which will basically allow voters decide on whether the 6-week ban should stay in place. He was asked about that and he said, oh, I'll tell you next week, even though he had called the 6-week ban terrible 7 months ago. So I think that really kind of highlights how uneasy this whole thing is for not just Trump, but all Republicans.
Yeah, I think we're going to get that statement next week, right between his healthcare plan and the proof that the election was stolen.
The healthcare plan was always 2 weeks away, wasn't it, for like 5 years?
Oh, so maybe that's a week after. No, but seriously, look, he succeeded in getting through the Republican primary toward the middle of everyone else running, right? He did not get boxed in to an extreme position on abortion. He did not commit to a certain number of weeks. He did not even commit to a national ban while he was still taking credit for overturning Roe versus Wade. And that's that clip that you're hearing the Democrats seizing on now. And so now he's feeling that pressure from holding together the entire Republican coalition, trying to balance out that appeal to the center that he, on this issue, clearly does understand, but still needing to shore up his right with the movement.
All right, well, let's take a break there. Then after the break, we will talk about Isaac's book and why the most interesting stories in politics right now aren't happening in Washington. We'll be right back.
On a summer night, Douglas Wagg Jr. lay motionless across a strip of railroad tracks before being struck by an oncoming train. I'm investigative journalist Delia D'Ambra, and my investigation into exactly how Doug died took me into the depths of a bizarre mystery.
It was really hard to understand what was fact and what wasn't.
A mystery that has led me from one suspicious death to another. Listen to Counterclock now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
So, Isaac, your book coming out this coming week. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's called Finish What We Started, and it is about the MAGA movement and specifically about how Trump Republicans have been taking this ground-up approach to trying to essentially influence the machinery of our election system. Explain a little bit about why this was something that you wanted to dive into for a book and about how you reported this out.
Yeah, it really is about the movement rather than Trump himself. And Trump himself is there a little bit at the beginning, and then he doesn't come back until the very end. And so it's doing something that's a little bit different from a lot of political books, which are very focused on the candidates and the campaigns and the professionals. And this is really a story about regular people, ordinary rank-and-file Republicans, and the journeys that they've taken over the past several years, either down the path of MAGA or down the path of struggling with how the party is changing.
And one of the things that you talk about in the book is this idea of a precinct strategy that has become this, like, hot topic in Republican circles and especially, like, MAGA circles. Explain what that is and why that has been important and might continue to be important in this election.
Yeah, so what happened after January 6th was, in the movement, the story went that the reason that Trump failed to stay in power was because of fellow Republicans who betrayed him. So the idea that took hold, and Steve Bannon had a huge part in popularizing this, was that Trump supporters needed to take over the Republican Party. And I hear you being like, wait a minute, like, Trump took over the Republican Party in 2016. But they're talking about literally the party, like the party organization. So there are these party committees that we often don't hear about, but actually matter a lot in politics behind the scenes. And they go, you know the Republican National Committee, and then there's a state committee and a district committee and a county committee. And all the way down at the bottom, there are these precincts. And so the idea is, like, if we go into the precincts where no one's really looking and we take over, and then we have this chain reaction all the way up the ladder, and we stack it with real MAGA Trump supporters, then we can purge the party of the Republicans who let Trump down, who weren't there for Trump when everything was on the line. And next time, we can make sure that doesn't happen.
Which is, I think...
Well, that's where we are now. I mean, that's sort of what's been happening since Trump left office. Mm-hmm. And that explains a lot of what we've been seeing with changes in leadership in the key battleground states, the parties and the candidates on the Republican side moving further right away from the center, even though they've actually been losing elections by antagonizing swing voters, independents, and even some Republicans. And even the ouster in the past few weeks of Ronna McDaniel, that is kind of the crowning achievement for this precinct strategy that bubbled all the way up from the bottom to the top of the pyramid.
Isaac, if I could just ask you, I think one big question always with Trump, and now that he's taken over the Republican Party, you know, in 2016, his campaign was kind of a loosey-goosey operation that didn't have a lot of structure to it. And it was a lot of people were responding to the man rather than a campaign apparatus. How organized is this effort? Like, is it really like people who are just so excited about Trump that they're willing to step forward and there's all kinds of different approaches to how this works? Or is there actually some kind of structure to this effort that's bubbled up from those precinct levels?
Well, excitement about Trump, but we should also specify, you know, specifically the idea that the election was stolen right in 2020 is really that animating force. But the beauty of it is that, you know, like, once Steve Bannon got up there and promoted this idea, and then people, the structure that it uses is the party structure. You know, there was already this existing huge, you know, like, federated grassroots infrastructure that was there for the taking. And so that's the structure that they're using. That's the organization that they're using. And the reason that matters is because it puts that ground game into play. You know, we talked about how the Trump campaign and the RNC have some money issues, they've got some organizational issues, but the party organization itself is more organized and disciplined in Trump's favor than it was previously. And that's because of the movement itself. That's something that came from the bottom up.
Isaac, you know, I'm interested in your point of view on this. We had a conversation last week on the show talking about Ronna McDaniel and the MSNBC thing and the idea that there is this question about whether any, like, relevant Republicans at this moment, like Republicans who side with Trump, who believe that the election was stolen, whether there's a space for that on TV and in media, and, like, how do we cover an election without highlighting the voices of people who are saying things that are untrue? And I think for you, I mean, reading this book was so fascinating because it was, there were these profiles of people who I think were in some ways more empathetic than I anticipated, and who had real personality and curiosities, but that they end up, like, wrapped up in MAGA world and really believing that the election was stolen and fighting in pretty profound ways on the side of Trump. And I'm just curious, like, how you have navigated this of, like, why it's important to talk to people and, like, get inside the heads of people who are on the ground doing things that in some cases are undermining our election system.
Look, I mean, you know, we as reporters have to be clear about what is empirically, observably true and what isn't. But we also have to be respectful about people's beliefs and people's passions and people's interests. And that's a huge part of what we do every day here at The Post, and a huge part of what I'm trying to do in the book. I guess the other thing I wanted to say, talking about Republicans who will or won't say that the election was stolen, is that it's like a vanishingly small group. But from talking with political scientists and political strategists and pollsters, those voices really, really matter. I mean, some of the most effective ads in, and the book talks about this also, how the Democrats and also anti-Trump Republicans in the midterms were able to really effectively use this message of, like, the struggling Republican, the agonizing Republican, the people who identify as Republicans, but, like, could not stomach these MAGA candidates, and how that became a really effective message against Republicans, the Republican MAGA candidates in the midterms. And that's something that Trump's opponents are very much trying to mobilize again in this election.
Mm. Yeah. And the flip side of the approach of pushing out the kind of rhinos in your midst is that, yes, it allows you to take over the party apparatus, but maybe take over the party apparatus of a party that is now a distinct minority in the country. So it's a choice that Trump and others have faced for a long time, which is, like, do you police these and push these people out, knowing that it could hurt you electorally? And the Bannon approach has always been very much that you mind your base, you take over the party, and then you try to kind of grow these views within that party in a way that you can win elections. But it's a very dicey strategy to be, you know, kind of casting out the Liz Cheneys of the party and policing people like this, I think.
Well, I think that is all the time that we have. But let me just say, it is a fascinating book, and it's out in stores on Tuesday. And for listeners, if you happen to be in the D.C. area, Isaac and I are going to be talking about the book in person at Politics and Prose next weekend on April 13th. It should be a ton of fun. So come join us, hear all about Isaac's spicy reporting. We will have information about that appearance in today's show notes and at postreports.com. And I know Aaron is coming.
I'm going to line up out the door for a week in advance. Like, I'm going to have a tent and everything. No, I'm seriously looking forward to this book. Like, this is a huge story. And I think the more that we can highlight what's happening at the local level, the better, because we all get kind of consumed with the national picture too much.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Isaac, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. This is great.
And Aaron, I will see you next week.
We will see you next week.
Isaac Arensdorf is a national political reporter at The Post and the author of Finish What We Started, The MAGA Movement's Ground War to End Democracy. And Aaron Blake is a senior political reporter and author of the Campaign Moment newsletter. And of course, you can find a link to subscribe to the newsletter in our show notes and at postreports.com. That is it for today's episode of The Campaign Moment, but it is not all that we have for you this week from Post Reports. Tomorrow, we've got a bonus episode that's all about spring cleaning. My co-host Elahe Azadi talks to reporter Rachel Curzius about this annual task that we all find incredibly daunting and stressful, but somehow in their hands is, like, fun and exciting.
The laundry chair is something that I think about a lot. I have one. I call it Clothes Mountain, and it's actually an entire bench, which is an improvement because it used to just be the top of my dresser.
Okay.
But
wow, that's quite a height for...
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's why it's Clothes Mountain, you know?
That is tomorrow on Post Reports. Today's episode was produced and mixed by Ted Muldoon. It was edited by Renita Jablonski and Allison Michaels. The rest of the Post Reports team also includes Maggie Penman, Rena Flores, Lucy Perkins, Monica Campbell, Alana Gordon, Ariel Plotnick, Bishop Sand, Renny Spranovsky, Sabi Robinson, Emma Talkoff, Sean Carter, Peter Bresnan, and Alahe Azadi. And I'm Martine Powers. Have a great weekend, and we will be back with more stories from The Washington Post.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.